Robert Langdon lay on a bed of coins at the bottom of the Fountain of the Four Rivers. His mouth was still wrapped around the plastic hose. He was not sure how accurate his imitation of a drowning man had been, but having been around water his entire life, Langdon had certainly heard accounts. He had done his best. Near the end, he had even blown all the air from his lungs and stopped breathing so that his muscle mass would carry his body to the floor. Thankfully, the Hashashin had again bought the fact of his death and let go. Now, resting on the bottom of the fountain, Langdon had waited as long as he could wait. He was about to start choking. Silently, he drifted upward, surfacing out of sight in the shadows beneath the huge marble figures. The van was gone. That was all Langdon needed to see. Pulling a long breath of fresh air back into his lungs, he waded away from the dead cardinal, back into deep water. Depleted and alone on the fountain, he half expected to collapse. But instead, he felt a new compulsion rising within him. Undeniable. Frantic. Find the Illuminati lair. Help Vittoria. Now turning to the mountainous core of Bernini's fountain, Langdon summoned hope and launched himself into his quest for the final Illuminati marker. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. But the fountain was pagan. It had no damn angels anywhere. Langdon checked his watch. It was 11 on the dot. Beaten and exhausted, he threw back his head to scream into the night. The sound jammed in his throat. Langdon was staring straight up the obelisk. The object perched at the very top was one he had seen earlier and ignored. Now, however, it stopped him short. It was not an angel. It was a pigeon. But he realized now it was not alive. Unmoving, it was perched high atop the obelisk, gazing calmly westward. The damn pigeon was bronzed. "You're looking for an angel, not a pigeon," a voice reminded him. But it was too late. Langdon had made the connection. He realized the bird was not a pigeon at all. It was a dove. Barely aware of his own actions, Langdon splashed toward the center of the fountain and began scrambling up the travertine mountain, clambering over huge arms and heads, pulling himself higher. Halfway to the base of the obelisk, he emerged from the mist and could see the head of the bird more clearly. There was no doubt, it was a dove. Suddenly the significance hit him. The lone dove is the pagan symbol for the angel of peace. The truth seemed to lift Langdon by the arms. He rose heavenward toward the dove. Finally, he could climb no higher. With one look around, though, he knew he didn't have to. All of Rome spread out before him. The view was stunning. To his left, the chaotic media lights surrounding St. Peter's. To his right, the smoking cupola of Santa Maria della Vittoria. In front of him, in the distance, Piazza del Popolo. Beneath him, the fourth and final point. A giant cross of obelisks. Trembling, Langdon looked to the dove overhead. He turned and faced the proper direction, and then he lowered his eyes to the skyline. In an instant, he saw it. So obvious, so clear, so deviously simple. Staring at it now, Langdon could not believe the Illuminati lair had stayed hidden for so many years. The building was as famous as any in Rome. It stood on the banks of the Tiber River, diagonally adjacent to the Vatican. The building's geometry was stark, a circular castle within a square fortress, and then, outside its walls, surrounding the entire structure, a park in the shape of a pentagram. Langdon climbed down and retrieved his tweed coat, holding it away from his dripping body. Then he jumped into the stolen sedan and rammed his soggy shoe into the accelerator, speeding off into the night. It was 11:07 p.m. Langdon's car raced through the Roman night, speeding down Lungo Tevere toward Inona, parallel with the river. Langdon could now see his destination rising like a mountain to his right. Castel Sant'Angelo, Castle of the Angel. Without warning, the turnoff to the narrow bridge of angels, Ponte Sant'Angelo, appeared suddenly. Langdon slammed on his brakes and swerved. He turned in time, but the bridge was barricaded. He skidded 10 feet and collided with a series of short cement pillars blocking his way. Shaken, Langdon staggered from the crumpled car. Aching and depleted, he broke into a loping run. On both sides of him now, like a gauntlet of escorts, a procession of Bernini angels whipped past, funneling him toward his final destination. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. The castle seemed to rise as he advanced, an unscalable peak, more intimidating to him even than St. Peter's. Langdon knew through the centuries the building had been used by the Vatican as a tomb, a fortress, a papal hideout, a prison for enemies of the church, and a museum. Apparently the castle had other tenants as well, the Illuminati. Somehow it made eerie sense. Although the castle was property of the Vatican, it was used only sporadically, and Bernini had made numerous renovations to it over the years. The building was now rumored to be honeycombed with secret entries, passageways, and hidden chambers. Arriving at the castle's elephantine double doors, Langdon shoved them hard. Not surprisingly, they were immovable. Vittoria, he thought, are you in there? Langdon hurried around the outer wall. There must be another entrance. Rounding the second bulwark to the west, he arrived breathless in a small parking area. On this wall he found a second castle entrance, a drawbridge-type ingress, raised and sealed shut. Langdon gazed upward again. The only lights on the castle were exterior floods, illuminating the facade. All the tiny windows inside seemed black. His eyes climbed higher. At the very peak of the central tower, 100 feet above, directly beneath the angel's sword, a single balcony protruded. The marble parapet seemed to shimmer slightly, as if the room beyond it were aglow with torchlight. Someone is up there. Vittoria, he called out, unable to help himself, but his voice was swallowed by the raging Tiber behind him. Across the lot, a large media truck was parked. Langdon ran toward it. A paunchy man in headphones sat in the cabin adjusting levers. Langdon rapped on the side of the truck. The man jumped, saw Langdon's dripping clothes, and yanked off his headset.
What's the worry, mate?
His accent was Australian.
I need your phone.
Langdon was frenzied. The man shrugged.
No dial tone. Circuits are picked.
Langdon swore aloud.
Have you seen anyone go in there?
He pointed to the drawbridge.
Actually, yeah. A black van's been going in and out all night.
Langdon felt a brick hit the bottom of his stomach.
Lucky bastard,
the Aussie said, gazing up at the tower and then frowning at his obstructed view of the Vatican.
I bet the view from up there is perfect. I couldn't get through the traffic in St. Peter's, so I'm shooting from here.
Langdon wasn't listening. He was looking for options.
What do you say?
The Australian said.
This 11th-hour Samaritan for real?
Langdon turned. This what?
You didn't hear? The captain of the Swiss Guard got a call from somebody who claims to have some primo info. The guy's flying in right now. All I know is if he saves the day, there go the ratings.
The man laughed. Langdon was suddenly confused. A good Samaritan flying in to help? Did the person somehow know where the antimatter was? Then why didn't he just tell the Swiss Guard? Why was he coming in person?
Hey,
the Aussie said, studying Langdon more closely.
Ain't you that guy I saw on TV? Trying to save that cardinal in St. Peter's Square?
Langdon didn't answer. His eyes had suddenly locked on a contraption attached to the top of the truck, a satellite dish on a collapsible appendage. Langdon looked at the castle again. The outer rampart was 50 feet tall. The inner fortress climbed farther still, a shelled defense. The top was impossibly high from here, but maybe if he could clear the first wall. Langdon spun to the newsman and pointed to the satellite arm.
How high does that go?
Huh? The man looked confused.
15 meters, why?
Move the truck. Park next to the wall. I need help getting in.
The Aussie's eyes went wide.
Are you insane? It's a $200,000 telescoping extension, not a ladder.
You want ratings? I've got information that'll make your day.
Langdon was desperate.
Information worth 200 grand?
Langdon told him what he would reveal in exchange for the favor. It worked. 90 seconds later, he was gripping the top of the satellite arm, waving in the breeze 50 feet off the ground. Leaning out, he grabbed the top of the first bulwark, dragged himself onto the wall, and dropped onto the castle's lower bastion.
Now, keep your bargain, the Aussie called up. Where is he?
Langdon felt guilt-ridden for revealing this information, but a deal was a deal. Besides, the Hashashin would probably call the press anyway.
Piazza Navona,
Langdon shouted.
He's in the fountain.
The Aussie lowered his satellite dish and peeled out after the scoop of his career. Langdon checked his watch. 11:12 p.m. Dashing down the stone ramp that hugged the inside of the wall, he descended to the courtyard. Back on ground level, he ran through shadows clockwise around the fort. He had circled almost the entire building when he saw a graveled drive cutting across the courtyard in front of him. At one end, on the outer wall of the castle, he saw the back of the gated drawbridge leading back outside. At the other end, the drive disappeared into the fortress. The drive seemed to enter a kind of tunnel, a gaping entry in the central core. Langdon felt almost exuberant as he ran toward the tunnel, but as he reached the opening, his excitement disappeared. The tunnel spiraled down, the wrong way. Still, with no other options, Langdon dashed down into the tunnel. It quickly grew darker as he descended. After one complete turn into the earth, the light was all but gone. The tunnel leveled out, and Langdon slowed, sensing by the echo of his footfalls that he had just entered a larger chamber. He moved forward, reaching out his hand. He found smooth surfaces, chrome and glass. It was a vehicle. He groped the surface, found a door, and opened it. The vehicle's interior dome light flashed on. He stepped back and recognized the black van immediately. He reached up and turned on the van's headlights. The room around him blazed into existence, harsh shadows in the simple chamber. At the end of his rope, Langdon jumped from the van and scanned the walls around him. No doorways, no gates. When he looked down and saw the blood on the floor, his first thought was for Vittoria. But as his eyes followed the stains, he realized they were bloody footprints. The strides were long. The splotches of blood were only on the left foot. The Hashashin. Langdon followed the footprints toward the corner of the room, his sprawling shadow growing fainter. He felt more and more puzzled with every step. The bloody prints looked as though they walked directly into the corner of the room and then disappeared. When Langdon arrived in the corner, he could not believe his eyes. The granite block in the floor here was not a square like the others. He was looking at another signpost. The block was carved into a perfect pentagram, arranged with the tip pointing into the corner. Ingeniously concealed by overlapping walls, a narrow slit in the stone served as an exit. Langdon slid through. He was in a passage. Up ahead, there was light. Langdon was running now. The passage quickly opened into another, larger chamber. Here, a single torch flickered on the wall. Langdon was in a section of the castle that had no electricity, a section no tourists would ever see. La prigione. There were a dozen tiny jail cells, the iron bars on most eroded away. One of the larger cells, however, remained intact, and on the floor, Langdon saw something that almost stopped his heart. Black robes and red sashes on the floor. This is where he held the cardinals. Near the cell was an iron doorway in the wall. The door was ajar, and beyond it, Langdon could see some sort of passage. He ran toward it. But Langdon stopped before he got there. The trail of blood did not enter the passage. When Langdon saw the words carved over the archway, he knew why. Il passetto. He was stunned. He had heard of this tunnel many times, never knowing where exactly the entrance was. Il passetto, the little passage, was a slender 3/4-mile tunnel built between Castel Sant'Angelo and the Vatican. It had been used by various popes to escape to safety during sieges of the Vatican, as well as by a few less pious popes to secretly visit mistresses or oversee the torture of their enemies. Nowadays, both ends of the tunnel were supposedly sealed with impenetrable locks, whose keys were kept in some Vatican vault. Langdon suddenly feared he knew how the Illuminati had been moving in and out of the Vatican. He found himself wondering who, on the inside, had betrayed the church and coughed up the keys. Olivetti? One of the Swiss Guard? The blood on the floor led to the opposite end of the prison. Langdon followed. Here, a rusty gate hung draped with chains. The lock had been removed, and the gate stood ajar. Beyond the gate was a steep ascension of spiral stairs. The trail of blood curved up the stairs. Before ascending, Langdon knew he needed a weapon. Any weapon. He found a 4-foot section of iron bar near one of the cells. It had a sharp, splintered end. Although absurdly heavy, it was the best he could do. The staircase's spiral treads were worn and twisted steeply upward. Langdon ascended into the total darkness, keeping one hand on the wall. As the stairs began narrowing, Langdon felt the passage closing around him. When he saw the horizontal shaft of light before him, he realized he was standing a few steps beneath a landing, where the glow of torchlight spilled out beneath the threshold of a door in front of him. Silently, he moved up. On the divan, Vittoria's arms ached. When she had first awoken to find them tied behind her back, she had thought she might be able to relax and work her hands free. But time had run out. The beast had returned. Now he was standing over her, his chest bare and powerful, scarred from battles he had endured. Vittoria felt a loathing horror. She closed her eyes. When she opened them again, the Hashashin had produced a switchblade knife. He snapped it open directly in front of her face.
This blade cut out your father's eye.
The Hashashin brought the knife to her khaki shorts and began sawing upward through the fabric. Suddenly he stopped, looking up. Someone was in the room.
Get away from her,
a deep voice growled from the doorway. Vittoria couldn't see who had spoken, but she recognized the voice. Robert, he's alive. The Hashashin looked as if he'd seen a ghost.
Mr. Langdon, you must have a guardian angel.
In the split second it took Langdon to take in his surroundings, he realized he was in a sacred place. The Church of Illumination, simple and pure. He had arrived. Directly in front of him, framed in the opening of the balcony, stood the Hashashin. He was bare-chested, standing over Vittoria, who lay bound but very much alive.
So we meet yet again,
the Hashashin said. He looked at the bar in Langdon's hand and laughed out loud.
And this time you come for me, with that.
Untie her. The Hashashin put the knife to Vittoria's throat.
I will kill her.
Langdon stepped forward, grasping the rusted bar, and aimed the splintered end directly at the Hashashin. The cut on his hand bit sharply.
Let her go.
The Hashashin seemed for a moment to be considering it. Exhaling, he dropped his shoulders. It was a clear motion of surrender. And yet, at that exact instant, the Hashashin's arm seemed to accelerate unexpectedly. There was a blur of dark muscle, and a blade suddenly came tearing through the air toward Langdon's chest. Whether it was instinct or exhaustion that buckled Langdon's knees at that moment, he didn't know, but the knife sailed past his left ear and clattered to the floor behind him. The Hashashin seemed unfazed. He smiled at Langdon, who was kneeling now, holding the metal bar. The killer stepped away from Vittoria and moved toward Langdon like a stalking lion. As Langdon scrambled to his feet, lifting the bar again, his wet turtleneck and pants felt restrictive. "There's still time," he ventured. "Tell me where the canister is. The Vatican will pay more than the Illuminati ever could."
"You are naive, Mr. Langdon."
Langdon jabbed with the bar. The Hashashin dodged. Oddly, he didn't seem interested in attacking or fleeing. He was simply playing Langdon's game, coolly waiting. "Waiting for what?" Langdon thought. "Perhaps he's trying to tire me out." It was working, too. He knew he had to make a move. The Hashashin seemed to read Langdon's mind, intentionally leading Langdon toward a table in the middle of the room. Langdon could tell there was something on the table. He tried to fight the obvious bait, but instinct overruled. He stole a glance. The damage was done. The sight momentarily riveted him. On the table lay a rudimentary copper chest, crusted with ancient patina. The chest was a pentagon. The lid lay open. Arranged inside in five padded compartments were five brands. The brands were forged of iron, large embossing tools with stout handles of wood. Langdon had no doubt what they said. Illuminati, earth, air, fire, water. Langdon snapped his head back up, fearing the Hashashin would lunge. He didn't. The killer was waiting, almost as if he were refreshed by the game. As the Hashashin maneuvered again, Langdon stole another glance downward. My God! In the chest, the five brands sat in compartments around the outer edge, but in the center there was another compartment. This partition was empty, but it clearly was intended to hold another brand, a brand much larger than the others, and perfectly square. The attack was a blur. The Hashashin swooped toward him like a bird of prey. Langdon, his concentration having been masterfully diverted, tried to counter, but the pipe felt like a tree trunk in his hands. His parry was too slow. The Hashashin dodged. As Langdon tried to retract the bar, the Hashashin's hands shot out and grabbed it. The hunter had become the hunted. Langdon cursed his carelessness as the Hashashin moved in. In frustration, he blurted, "I've never read anything about a sixth Illuminati brand." The killer chuckled as he herded Langdon around the oval wall.
"It's a perfect union of the ancient elements. I'm afraid you will never see it, though."
Langdon sensed he would not be seeing much of anything in a moment. He kept backing up, searching the room for an option.
"Where is this final brand?" he demanded, trying to buy time.
"Not here. Janus is apparently the only one who holds it."
"Janus?"
"The Illuminati leader. He's arriving shortly to perform the final branding in the Vatican."
Langdon shot a frightened glance to Vittoria. She looked strangely calm, her eyes closed to the world around her, her lungs pulling slowly, deeply. He tried to make sense of the Hashashin's words. Who was there left to brand? Langdon found the answer in the vacuum of the Hashashin's eyes. The Camerlengo.
"You'll never get to him," Langdon challenged.
"Not I," the Hashashin replied, forcing Langdon farther back around the wall. "That honor is reserved for Janus himself. He has an appointment."
Langdon was confused. The only person expected at the Vatican right now was the person the press was calling the 11th Hour Samaritan. The person Roche said had information that could save... Langdon stopped short.
Good God!
The Hashashin smirked, clearly enjoying Langdon's sickening cognition.
I too wondered how Janus would gain entrance. Then in the van I heard the radio. A report about an 11th-hour Samaritan, he smiled. The Vatican will welcome Janus with open arms.
Suddenly Langdon felt the wall behind him disappear. There was a rush of cool air, and he staggered backward into the night. The balcony. He now realized what the Hashashin had in mind. He could sense the precipice behind him, a 100-foot drop to the courtyard below. Certainly the next jab of the spear would kill him. He attempted the absurd. Spinning to one side, he reached out and grabbed the shaft, sending a jolt of pain through his palm. The Hashashin seemed unfazed. The two men strained for a moment against one another, face to face, the Hashashin's breath fetid in Langdon's nostrils. The bar began to slip. The Hashashin was too strong. Langdon had just played his final card, and he knew he had lost the hand. The Hashashin's arms exploded upward, driving Langdon back against the railing. Langdon sensed nothing but empty space behind him as the railing hit just beneath his buttocks. Looming over him, the Hashashin raised the bar overhead, preparing to bring it crashing down. As the bar began to accelerate, Langdon saw a vision, a sudden aura surrounding the Hashashin, like an incoming fireball. Halfway through his swing, the Hashashin dropped the bar and screamed in agony. The iron bar clattered past Langdon out into the night. The Hashashin spun away from him, and Langdon saw a blistering torch burn on the killer's back. Langdon straightened up to see Vittoria, eyes flaring, now facing the Hashashin. Vittoria waved a torch in front of her, the vengeance in her face resplendent in the flames. How she had escaped, Langdon did not know or care. He began moving forward. The battle would be short. The Hashashin was a deadly match. Screaming with rage, the killer lunged for her. She tried to dodge, but the man was on her, holding the torch and about to wrestle it away. Langdon didn't wait. Moving away from the banister, he jabbed his clenched fist into the blistered burn on the Hashashin's back. The scream seemed to echo all the way to the Vatican. The Hashashin froze a moment, his back arched in anguish. He let go of the torch, and Vittoria thrust it hard into his face. There was a hiss of flesh as his left eye sizzled. He screamed again, raising his hands to his face.
"Eye for an eye," Vittoria hissed.
This time she swung the torch like a bat, and when it connected, the Hashashin stumbled back against the railing. Langdon and Vittoria went for him at the same instant, both heaving and pushing. The Hashashin's body sailed backward, over the banister, into the night. Langdon turned and stared at Vittoria in bewilderment. Slackened ropes hung off her midsection and shoulders. Her eyes blazed like an inferno.
"Houdini knew yoga," she said.
Meanwhile, inside the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortatti was getting restless. It was past 11:15 p.m. Many of the cardinals were continuing to pray, but others had clustered around the exit, clearly unsettled by the hour. Some of the cardinals began pounding on the door with their fists. Outside the door, Lieutenant Chartrand heard the pounding and didn't know what to do. Captain Roche had given strict orders that the cardinals were not to be let out until he gave the word. Chartrand pulled out his walkie-talkie.
"Captain, Chartrand here. It is past time. Should I open the Sistine?"
"The door stays shut," came the reply. "Our guest is arriving shortly. Take a few men upstairs and guard the door of the Pope's office. The Camerlengo is not to go anywhere."
11:23 p.m. Vittoria stood trembling on the balcony of Castel Sant'Angelo, staring out across Rome, her eyes moist with tears. I'm going back, Langdon said flatly. Vittoria turned, incredulous.
Into the Vatican?
Langdon told her about the Samaritan and how it was a ploy. The Illuminati leader, a man named Janus, was actually coming himself to brand the Camerlengo.
Nobody in Vatican City knows, Langdon said. I have no way to contact them, and this guy is arriving any minute. I have to warn the guards before they let him in. But you'll never get through the crowd.
Langdon's voice was confident. There's a way, trust me. Vittoria sensed once again that the historian knew something she didn't.
I'm coming.
No, why risk both? Just then, the balcony they were standing on began to shake. A deafening rumble shook the whole castle. Then a white light from the direction of St. Peter's blinded them. Langdon looked baffled.
What the devil?
The sky overhead roared. Emerging from behind the tower, without warning, came the papal helicopter. It thundered 50 feet above them, on a beeline for Vatican City. A few seconds later, the mammoth machine slowed to a stop over St. Peter's Square. Kicking up a cloud of dust, the chopper dropped into the open portion of the square between the crowds and the basilica, touching down at the bottom of the basilica's staircase.
Talk about an entrance, Vittoria said.
Against the white marble, she could see a tiny speck of a person emerge from the Vatican and move toward the chopper. She would never have recognized the figure except for the bright red beret on his head.
Red carpet greeting. That's Roche.
Langdon pounded his fist on the banister.
Somebody's got to warn them.
He turned to go. Vittoria caught his arm.
Wait!
She had just seen something else, something her eyes refused to believe. Fingers trembling, she pointed toward the chopper. Even from this distance, there was no mistaking. Descending the gangplank was another figure, a figure who moved so uniquely that it could only be one man. A king on an electric throne. It was Maximilian Kohler. Roche led Kohler up a handicapped ramp on a circuitous route into the Apostolic Palace.
No elevator?
Kohler demanded.
No power.
Roche motioned to the candles burning around them in the darkened building.
Part of our search tactic.
When they reached the top floor and started down the hallway toward the Pope's office, 4 Swiss guards ran toward them, looking troubled.
Captain, what are you doing up here? I thought this man had information that...
He will only speak to the Camerlengo.
The guards recoiled, looking suspicious.
Tell the Camerlengo, Roche said forcefully, that the director of CERN, Maximilian Kohler, is here to see him. Immediately.
Yes, sir.
One of the guards ran off in the direction of the Camerlengo's office. The others stood their ground, but Kohler maneuvered his chair around the sentinels. He knew he had very little time to accomplish what he had come for. He also knew he might die here tonight. He was surprised how little he cared. Death was a price he was ready to pay. He had endured too much in his life to have his work destroyed by someone like Camerlengo Ventresca. When Kohler entered the Pope's office, Camerlengo Ventresca was alone, kneeling in prayer beside a dying fire. He did not open his eyes.
Mr. Kohler, the Camerlengo said, have you come to make me a martyr?
Meanwhile, moving through the narrow tunnel called Il Passetto, Langdon and Vittoria dashed toward Vatican City. The torch in Langdon's hand threw only enough light to see a few yards ahead.
Kohler can't be Janus, Vittoria declared as they kept running. Max would never do anything to damage CERN's reputation.
You know what promoter P.T. Barnum said? Langdon called over his shoulder. I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right. I bet people are already secretly lined up to license antimatter technology. And after they see its true power at midnight tonight.
Illogical, Vittoria said. Publicizing scientific breakthroughs is not about showing destructive power. This is terrible for antimatter, trust me.
Langdon's torch was fading now.
Then maybe it's all much simpler than that. Maybe Kohler never counted on the Camerlengo becoming a new church leader, and now Kohler is coming to kill him.
Max is a bastard, Vittoria declared, but he's not a murderer, and he would never have been involved in my father's assassination.
No? Well, if Kohler's not involved, Langdon challenged, what is he doing here?
The outline of a steel gate loomed ahead, blocking their progress down the tunnel. Langdon's heart almost stopped. When they approached, however, they found the ancient lock hanging open. The gate swung freely. Langdon breathed a sigh of relief, realizing, as he had suspected, that the ancient tunnel was in use. Recently. As in today. He now had little doubt that four terrified cardinals had been secreted through here earlier. They ran on. Langdon could now hear the sounds of chaos to his left. It was St. Peter's Square. They were getting close. They hit another gate, this one heavier. It, too, was unlocked. He wondered where inside the Vatican this ancient passage would conclude. In the gardens? In the basilica? In the papal residence? Then, without warning, the tunnel ended. The cumbrous door blocking their way was a thick wall of riveted iron. Even by the last flickers of his torch, Langdon could see that the portal was perfectly smooth. No handles, no knobs, no keyholes, no hinges. No entry. Langdon's hope dimmed to black, along with the torch in his hand. With a scream of frustration, he swung the torch and started pounding on the door. Something was wrong. Lieutenant Chartrand stood outside the Pope's office and sensed in the uneasy stance of the soldiers standing with him that they shared the same anxiety. The private meeting they were shielding, Rocher had said, could save the Vatican from destruction. So Chartrand wondered why his protective instincts were tingling. And why was Rocher acting so strangely? Something definitely was awry. Captain Rocher stood to Chartrand's right, staring dead ahead, his sharp gaze uncharacteristically distant. Chartrand barely recognized the captain. Rocher had not been himself in the last hour. His decisions made no sense. Someone should be present inside this meeting, Chartrand thought. He had heard Maximilian Kohler bolt the door after he entered. Why had Rocher permitted this? But there was so much more bothering Chartrand. The cardinals. The cardinals were still locked in the Sistine Chapel. This was absolute insanity. The Camerlengo had wanted them evacuated 15 minutes ago. Rocher had overruled the decision and not informed the Camerlengo. Suddenly, Chartrand's thoughts were jolted by an unexpected sound. A banging coming from down the hall. The pounding was distant and muffled, but incessant. Rocher looked up. The captain turned to Chartrand and motioned down the hall. Chartrand understood. He turned on his flashlight and took off to investigate. The banging was more desperate now. Chartrand ran 30 yards down the corridor to the door of the Pope's private library. The banging was coming from somewhere inside. Tentatively, he reached for the doorknob and turned. As he had imagined, the door was locked. Then he heard something else. Voices. Someone calling out. He couldn't make out the words, but he could hear the panic in their shouts. Was someone trapped in the library? Chartrand pulled out his sidearm and fired a single shot into the door latch. The wood exploded and the door swung open. The banging was clearer now. Chartrand shone his light across the room toward the sound. On the far wall, beyond the sitting area, was a huge door made of iron. It had four mammoth locks. The tiny etched letters dead center of the door took Chartrand's breath away. Il Passetto. Chartrand stared. The Pope's secret escape route. Who could be banging on the other side? Chartrand took his flashlight and rapped on the door. There was a muffled exultation from the other side. The banging stopped and the voices yelled louder. Chartrand's gaze fell to the middle of the door. Emerging from the keyholes of each of the door's massive locks were keys.
He blinked in disbelief. The keys to this door were supposed to be in a vault someplace. The passage was never used, not for centuries. Chartrand dropped his flashlight on the floor. He grabbed the first key and turned. The mechanism was rusted and stiff, but it still worked. Someone had opened it recently. Chartrand worked the next lock, and the next. When the last bolt slid aside, Chartrand pulled. The slab of iron creaked open. He grabbed his light and shone it into the passage. Robert Langdon and Vittoria Vetra looked like apparitions as they staggered into the library. Both were ragged and tired, but they were very much alive.
"What is this?" Chartrand demanded. "What's going on? Where did you come from?"
"Where's Max Kohler?" Langdon demanded. Chartrand pointed.
"In a private meeting with the camera..."
Langdon and Vittoria pushed past him and ran down the darkened hall. Chartrand turned, instinctively raising his gun at their backs. He quickly lowered it and ran after them. Roche apparently heard them coming, because as they arrived outside the Pope's office, Roche had spread his legs in a protective stance and was leveling his gun at them.
"Alt!
The Camerlingo is in danger!" Langdon yelled, raising his arms in surrender as he slid to a stop.
"Open the door! Max Kohler is going to kill the Camerlingo!"
But it was too late. From inside the Pope's office came a blood-curdling scream. It was the Camerlingo. Camerlingo Ventresca was still screaming when Chartrand stepped past Roche and blew open the door of the Pope's office. The guards dashed in. Langdon and Vittoria ran in behind them. The scene before them was staggering. The chamber was lit only by candlelight and a dying fire. Kohler was near the fireplace, standing awkwardly in front of his wheelchair. He brandished a pistol, aimed at the Camerlingo, who lay on the floor at his feet, writhing in agony. The Camerlingo's cassock was torn open, and his bare chest was seared black. Langdon could not make out the symbol from across the room, but a large, square brand lay on the floor near Kohler. The metal still glowed red. Two of the Swiss guards acted without hesitation. They opened fire. The bullets smashed into Kohler's chest, driving him backward. Kohler collapsed into his wheelchair, his chest gurgling blood. His gun went skittering across the floor. Langdon stood stunned in the doorway. Vittoria seemed paralyzed.
"Max!" she whispered.
The Camerlingo, still twisting on the floor, rolled toward Roche, and with the trance-like terror of the early witch hunts, pointed his index finger at Roche and yelled a single word,
"Illuminatus!"
"You bastard," Roche said, running at him. "You sanctimonious best!" This time it was Chartrand who reacted on instinct, putting three bullets in Roche's back. The captain fell face first on the tile floor and slid lifeless through his own blood. Chartrand and the guards dashed immediately to the Camerlingo, who lay clutching himself, convulsing in pain. Both guards let out exclamations of horror when they saw the symbol seared on the Camerlingo's chest. Chartrand, looking equally overwhelmed by the symbol, pulled the Camerlingo's torn cassock up over the burn, shielding it from view. As the Camerlingo was being attended, Langdon felt himself drawn toward the smoking brand on the floor near Kohler's wheelchair. The sixth brand? The closer Langdon got, the more confused he became. The brand seemed to be a perfect square, quite large, and had obviously come from the sacred center compartment of the chest in the Illuminati lair. Langdon knelt beside Kohler and reached for the object. The metal still radiated heat. Grasping the wooden handle, Langdon picked it up. He wasn't sure what he expected to see, but it most certainly wasn't this. Why had the guards cried out in horror when they saw it? It was a square of meaningless squiggles. When he felt a hand on his shoulder, Langdon looked up, expecting Vittoria. The hand, however, was covered with blood. It belonged to Maximilian Kohler, who was reaching out from his wheelchair.
Langdon dropped the brand and staggered to his feet. The scientist's body quivered, and Langdon sensed he was trying to move. Everyone else in the room was focused on the Camerlengo, and Langdon wanted to call out, but he could not react. He was transfixed by the intensity radiating from Kohler in these final seconds of his life. The director, with tremulous effort, lifted his arm and pulled a small device off the arm of his wheelchair. It was the size of a matchbox. He held it out, quivering. For an instant, Langdon feared Kohler had a weapon, but it was something else.
"Give."
Kohler's final words were a gurgling whisper.
"Give this to the media."
Kohler collapsed motionless, and the device fell in his lap. Shocked, Langdon stared at the device. It was electronic. The words Sony Ruvi were printed across the front. Langdon recognized it as one of those new ultra-miniature palm-held camcorders. "The balls on this guy," he thought, slipping it into his deepest jacket pocket. "Kohler's final message can rot in hell." It was the voice of the Camerlengo that broke the silence. He was trying to sit up.
"The Cardinals," he gasped to Chartrand. "Still in the Sistine Chapel," Chartrand explained. "Captain Rocher ordered, evacuate now, everyone."
Chartrand sent one of the other guards running off to let the Cardinals out. The Camerlengo grimaced in pain.
"Helicopter, out front. Get me to a hospital."
In St. Peter's Square, the Swiss Guard pilot sat in the cockpit of the parked Vatican helicopter and rubbed his temples. Lieutenant Chartrand had just radioed with terrible news. The Camerlengo had been attacked by Maximilian Kohler and seriously injured. A clamor arose from the crowd, and the pilot looked over to see a line of cardinals processing solemnly out of the Vatican onto St. Peter's Square. The cardinals' relief to be leaving Ground Zero seemed to be quickly overcome by looks of bewilderment at the spectacle now going on outside the church. It was 11:39 when Langdon stepped with the others from St. Peter's Basilica. The glare that hit his eyes was searing. In front of him, a collage of massive video screens rose above the crowd. Standing there atop the magnificent stairs that spilled down to the piazza below, Langdon felt like a reluctant player on the world's biggest stage. Somewhere beyond the glaring lights, he heard an idling helicopter and the roar of 100,000 voices. To their left, a procession of cardinals was now evacuating onto the square.
"Careful now,"
Chartrand urged, sounding focused as he, another guard, Langdon, and Vittoria began descending the stairs toward the helicopter. Unable to find anything more suitable, the four of them were transporting the wounded Camerlengo on a narrow table, balancing the inert body among them as though on a stretcher. Langdon felt like they were moving underwater. His arms ached from the weight of the Camerlengo on the table. He wondered how the moment could get much less dignified. Then he saw the answer. The two BBC reporters, Glick and Macri, were running toward them. Macri's camera was raised and rolling. "This is wrong," Langdon thought. He wanted to run down the stairs and interfere, but he couldn't. It wouldn't have helped anyway. Whether it was the roar of the crowd or the cool night air that caused it, Langdon would never know. But at that moment, the inconceivable occurred. Like a man awakening from a nightmare, the Camerlengo's eyes shot open and he sat bolt upright. Taken entirely by surprise, Langdon and the others fumbled with the shifting weight. The front of the table dipped. The Camerlengo began to slide. They tried to recover by setting the table down, but it was too late. The Camerlengo slid off the front. Incredibly, he didn't fall. His feet hit the marble, and he swayed upright. He stood a moment, looking disoriented, and then, before anyone could stop him, he lurched forward, staggering down the stairs toward Macri. The scene went from bad to worse. The Camerlengo's torn cassock slid off his shoulders down around his waist. The gasp that went up from the crowd seemed to travel around the globe and back in an instant. Cameras rolled, flashbulbs exploded. On media screens everywhere, the image of the Camerlengo's branded chest was projected, towering and in grisly detail. Langdon stared at the brand on the screens. Although it was the imprint of the square brand he had held earlier, the symbol now made sense. Perfect sense. The marking's awesome power hit Langdon like a train. A flawless diamond, born of the ancient elements with such perfection that all those who saw it could only stare in wonder, he quoted. Earth, air, fire, water. The Illuminati Diamond. As the tragedy unfolded, the action seemed to distend, as if in a time warp, all the insanity slowing to a crawl. The Camerlengo, as if in some sort of post-traumatic trance, began babbling, whispering to unseen spirits, looking up at the sky and raising his arms to God.
Speak! The Camerlengo yelled to the heavens. Yes, I hear you.
At that moment, Langdon understood. His heart dropped like a rock. Victoria apparently understood, too. She went white.
He's in shock, she said. He's hallucinating. He thinks he's talking to God.
Below them on the stairs, Chinita Macri was poised and filming, apparently having located her ideal vantage point. The images she filmed appeared instantly across the square behind her on media screens, like endless drive-in movies, all playing the same grisly tragedy. The whole scene felt epic. The Camerlengo looked almost Christ-like, bare and wounded before the world. He raised his arms to the heavens and, looking up, exclaimed,
Grazie! Grazie Dio!
Thank you, God? Langdon stared in wonder. The Camerlengo was radiant now, his eerie transformation complete. He looked up at the sky, still nodding furiously. He shouted to the heavens,
Upon this rock I will build my church!
The man had clearly gone mad. The world watched, spellbound. With a final joyous exultation, the Camerlengo turned and dashed back into St. Peter's Basilica. 11:42 p.m. The frenzied convoy that plunged back into the basilica to retrieve the Camerlengo was lit by the spotlight on top of Chinita Macri's camera. Far off, in the grayness at the end of the spotlight's reach, black fabric billowed, revealing a familiar form running down the main aisle of the basilica. The Camerlengo's voice rang out joyously.
Upon this rock I will build my church!
Chartrand knew the man was shouting scripture. Matthew, chapter 16, verse 18, if Chartrand recalled correctly. Surely the Camerlengo had gone mad. Or had he? 50 yards ahead, in the center of the church, a ghost appeared. A diaphanous, glowing outline. The pale shape was that of the half-naked Camerlengo. As Chartrand watched, the body seemed to shine brighter. Then it began to sink. Deeper and deeper, until it disappeared, as if by magic, into the blackness of the floor. Langdon had seen the phantom also. As he passed the stunned Chartrand and ran toward the spot where the Camerlengo had disappeared, he realized what had just happened. The Camerlengo had arrived at the niche of the paliums, a sunken chamber famously lit by 99 oil lamps. The lamps in the niche shone up from beneath, illuminating him like a ghost. Then, as the Camerlengo descended the stairs into the light, he had seemed to disappear beneath the floor. Langdon arrived breathless at the rim overlooking the sunken room. He peered down the stairs. At the bottom, lit by the golden glow of oil lamps, the Camerlengo dashed across the marble chamber toward a set of glass doors. He yanked open the doors and ran inside. A few seconds later, he dropped to his knees and began struggling to lift an iron grate embedded in the floor. Langdon watched in horror, now realizing where the Camerlengo was headed.
Good God, no!
He dashed down the stairs after him. "Father, don't!"
As Langdon opened the glass doors and ran toward the Camerlengo, he saw the Camerlengo heave on the grate. The hinged iron bulkhead fell open with a deafening crash, revealing a narrow shaft and a steep stairway that dropped into nothingness. As the Camerlengo moved toward the hole, Langdon grabbed his bare shoulders and pulled him back.
"Father," Langdon urged as calmly as possible, "you can't go down there. We need to evacuate."
"My son," the Camerlengo said, his voice eerily sane, "I have just had a message. I know."
"Camerlengo!"
It was Chartrand and the others. They came dashing down the stairs into the room, lit by Macri's camera. When Chartrand saw the open grate in the floor, his eyes filled with dread. He crossed himself and shot Langdon a thankful look for having stopped the Camerlengo. Langdon understood. He had read enough about Vatican architecture to know what lay beneath that grate. It was the most sacred place in all of Christendom. Terra Santa, holy ground. Some called it the necropolis. Some called it the catacombs. It was not the kind of place through which they wanted to be chasing the Camerlengo.
"Signore," Chartrand pleaded, "you're in shock. We need to leave this place. You cannot go down there. It's suicide."
The Camerlengo seemed suddenly stoic. He reached out and put a quiet hand on Chartrand's shoulder.
"I know where the antimatter is."
Everyone stared. Macri moved in for a closer shot. Glick was mute, as if shell-shocked. The Camerlengo spoke quickly now.
"The Illuminati have placed their tool of destruction on the very cornerstone of this church, at the foundation."
He motioned down the stairs.
"On the very rock upon which this church was built. Pietro e la Pietra."
Langdon froze. In an instant it all came clear. The austere simplicity of it gave him chills.
"Pietro e la Pietra.
Peter is the rock." Peter's faith in God was so steadfast that Jesus called Peter the rock, the unwavering disciple on whose shoulders Jesus would build his church. On this very location, Langdon realized, Vatican Hill, Peter had been crucified and buried. The early Christians built a small shrine over his tomb. As Christianity spread, the shrine got bigger, layer upon layer, culminating in this colossal basilica. The entire Catholic faith had been built, quite literally, upon St. Peter, the rock.
"The antimatter is on St. Peter's tomb," the Camerlengo said, his voice crystalline. "And if you all need worldly proof," he added, sounding impatient now, "I just found that grate unlocked."
He pointed to the open bulkhead on the floor.
"It is never unlocked. Someone has been down there, recently."
"I'm going to die down here,"
Vittoria thought, gripping the heavy rope banister as she bounded down the cramped passageway behind the Camerlengo, Langdon, and Chartrand. Far below, she could see the golden glow of the Camerlengo's oil lamp. Behind her, she could hear the BBC reporters hurrying to keep up. As the bizarre chase continued, Vittoria's thoughts whipped like a tempest. What could the Camerlengo possibly do down here? Even if he found the antimatter, there was no time. Suddenly, the Camerlengo's lantern seemed to halt. Langdon closed on him fast. The end of the stairs loomed abruptly from out of the shadows. A wrought iron gate with three embossed skulls blocked the bottom of the stairs. The Camerlengo was there, pulling the gate open. Langdon leapt, pushing the gate shut, blocking the Camerlengo's way. The others came thundering down the stairs, everyone ghostly white in the BBC spotlight. Chartrand grabbed Langdon.
"Let the Camerlengo pass."
"No," Vittoria said from above, breathless. "We must evacuate right now. You cannot take the antimatter out of here. If you bring it up, everyone outside will die."
The Camerlengo's voice was remarkably calm.
"Please,
some faith. I am not asking anyone to join me. You are all free to go. All I am asking is that you not interfere with God's bidding. I am to save this church, and I can. I swear on my life.
The Camerlengo turned and moved deeper into the shadows. Following him, Langdon felt like it was moving through the pages of history. Somewhere ahead was St. Peter's tomb, the Christian relic. He checked his watch. 8 minutes. He was beginning to wonder if he and Vittoria would be joining the deceased here permanently. Suddenly the path ended. The necropolis came to an abrupt halt at a wall of earth. A tiny marker read, Mausoleum S, La Tomba di San Pietro. The Camerlengo set down his oil lamp and knelt to pray.
Thank you, God. It is almost over.
Outside in the square, surrounded by astounded cardinals, Cardinal Mortatti stared up at the media screen and watched the drama unfold in the crypt below.
Look!
A gasp went up from the throngs.
There!
Everyone was suddenly pointing at the screen.
It's a miracle!
The terracotta casket of San Pietro. Mortatti was not naive enough to think that the shouts of joy and amazement now thundering through the crowd were exaltations from bearing witness to one of Christianity's most sacred relics. St. Peter's tomb was not what had people falling to their knees in spontaneous prayer and thanksgiving. It was the object on top of his tomb, the antimatter canister. It was there, where it had been all day, hiding in the darkness of the necropolis. The Camerlengo's revelation was correct. Mortatti stared in wonder at the transparent cylinder. The globule of liquid still hovered at its core. The grotto around the canister blinked red as the LED counted down into its final 5 minutes of life. Also sitting on the tomb, inches away from the canister, was the wireless Swiss Guard security camera that had been pointed at the canister and transmitting all along. The Camerlengo erupted through the doors of St. Peter's Basilica at exactly 11:56 p.m. He staggered into the dazzling glare of the world spotlight, carrying the antimatter before him like some sort of numinous offering. Through burning eyes, he could see his own form, half-naked and wounded, towering like a giant on the media screens around the square. The roar that went up from the crowd in St. Peter's Square was like none the Camerlengo had ever heard. Crying, screaming, chanting, praying, a mix of veneration and terror.
"Deliver us from evil," he whispered.
He felt totally depleted from his race out of the necropolis. It had almost ended in disaster. Robert Langdon and Vittoria Vetra had wanted to intercept him, to throw the canister back into its subterranean hiding place, to run outside for cover. But Langdon, on the verge of overtaking the Camerlengo, had been grabbed by Chartrand, ever trusting and dutiful to the Camerlengo's demands for faith. The reporters, of course, were spellbound and lugging too much equipment to interfere. Now the Camerlengo could hear the others behind him, see them on the screens, closing in. Mustering the last of his physical strength, he raised the antimatter high over his head. Then, throwing back his bare shoulders in an act of defiance to the Illuminati brand on his chest, he dashed down the stairs. There was one final act.
Godspeed, he thought. Godspeed.
Langdon ran down the stairs after the Camerlengo.
Father, he screamed, there's nowhere to go. Look to the heavens, my son. We forget to look to the heavens.
In that moment, as Langdon saw where the Camerlengo was headed, the glorious truth came flooding all around him. Although Langdon could not see it on account of the lights, he knew their salvation was directly overhead. The star-filled Italian sky. The escape route. The helicopter the Camerlengo had summoned to take him to the hospital sat dead ahead. pilot already in the cockpit, blades already humming in neutral. As the Camerlengo ran toward it, Langdon felt a sudden, overwhelming exhilaration. If they could fly the canister far enough out to sea and drop it. With the entire world watching in wonder, the Camerlengo ran around the chopper to the pilot's door and yanked it open.
Out, son, now!
The guard jumped out. The Camerlengo looked at the high cockpit seat and knew that in his exhausted state he would need both hands to pull himself up. He turned to the pilot, trembling beside him, and thrust the canister into his hands.
Hold this. Hand it back when I'm in.
As the Camerlengo pulled himself up, he could hear Robert Langdon yelling excitedly, running toward the craft.
Now you understand, the Camerlengo thought. Now you have faith.
The Camerlengo pulled himself up into the cockpit, adjusted a few familiar levers, and then turned back to his window for the canister. But the guard to whom he had given the canister stood empty-handed.
He took it, the guard yelled.
Robert Langdon was surprised by how heavy the canister was. He ran to the other side of the chopper and jumped in the rear compartment where he and Vittoria had sat only hours ago. He left the door open and buckled himself in. Then he yelled to the Camerlengo in the front seat.
Fly, father!
The Camerlengo seemed momentarily paralyzed, the media lights glaring through the cockpit, darkening the creases in his face.
I can do this alone, he whispered. I am supposed to do this alone.
Langdon wasn't listening. He looked down at the canister and felt his breath catch in his throat when he saw the numbers.
3 minutes, father. 3.
The number seemed to stun the Camerlengo back to sobriety. Without hesitation, he turned back to the controls. With a grinding roar, the helicopter lifted off. Inside the chopper, the whine of the engines and the gale from the open door assaulted Langdon's senses with a deafening chaos. He steadied himself against the magnified drag of gravity as the Camerlengo accelerated the craft straight up.
2 minutes,
Langdon yelled, wondering where the Camerlengo intended to drop the canister. The city lights beneath them spread out in all directions. In the distance to the west, Langdon could see the twinkling delineation of the Mediterranean coast, a jagged border of luminescence beyond which spread an endless dark expanse of nothingness. The sea looked farther now than Langdon had imagined. Moreover, the concentration of lights at the coast was a stark reminder that even far out at sea, an explosion might have devastating effects. Langdon had not even considered the effects of a 10-kiloton tidal wave hitting the coast. But the ocean wasn't getting any closer, even as the engines strained louder and the chopper hurtled through the air. Bewildered, Langdon shot a glance out the side door to get his bearings. What he saw plunged him into a new wave of panic. Directly beneath them, thousands of feet straight down, glowed the media lights in St. Peter's Square.
We're still over the Vatican. Camerlengo, Langdon choked. Go forward. We're high enough. You've got to start moving forward, to the ocean. We don't have...
No, the Camerlengo said. It's far too dangerous. I'm sorry.
As the chopper continued to claw heavenward, the Camerlengo turned and gave Langdon a mournful smile.
I wish you had not come, my friend. You have made the ultimate sacrifice.
Langdon looked in the Camerlengo's exhausted eyes and suddenly understood. His blood turned to ice.
But there must be somewhere we can go.
Up, the Camerlengo replied, his voice resigned.
It's the only guarantee.
Langdon could barely think. He had entirely misinterpreted the Camerlengo's plan.
Look to the heavens.
This was a one-way trip. In St. Peter's Square, Vittoria Vetra stared upward as, cruelly, the bells of St. Peter's began to toll. Vittoria let her tears come as, with the whole world watching, time ran out. High above Vatican City, a pinpoint of light appeared in the sky. For a fleeting instant, a new heavenly body had been born, a speck of light as pure and white as anyone had ever seen. Then it happened. A flash. The point billowed, as if feeding on itself, unraveling across the sky in a dilating radius of blinding white. It shot out in all directions, accelerating with incomprehensible speed, gobbling up the dark. Blinded, the multitudes of starkly lit human faces gasped as one, shielding their eyes, crying out in strangled fear. And then the unimaginable occurred. As if bound by God's own will, the surging radius of light seemed to hit a wall. It was as if the explosion were contained somehow in a giant glass sphere. The light rebounded inward, sharpening, rippling across itself. The wave appeared to have reached a predetermined diameter and hovered there. Then it hit. The concussion was deep and hollow, a thunderous shockwave from above. It descended on them like the wrath of hell, shaking the granite foundation of Vatican City, knocking the breath out of people's lungs, sending others stumbling backward. Then, as fast as it appeared, the sphere imploded, sucking back in on itself, crushing inward to the tiny point of light from which it had come.